This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Friday, everyone. We hope you had a Thanksgiving full of friends, family, and food. And as you recover from your turkey hangover, we have just the thing to help. An hour of easily digested conversations with our favorite musicians and composers. We've spoken to artists with great international followings and undiscovered gems right here at home, like the creator of this sunny song.
C to the O, to the O, to the ball, to the spoon. Ball to the spoon, to the mouth of the boy in the room.
This is the new TV commercial for Cheerios cereal. It's called Good Goes Round. And while Cheerios is a global brand, the music for the spot originated right here. It's by Dorchester hip-hop artist Latrell James.
Good goes round and around and around. See to the oats, to the O on the first day of school.
James put a sunny, feel-good swing into the Cheerios spot, but it's the tracks from his other work that's really worth listening to. Songs about the reality of his life and experience that carry gravitas and poetry in each jam-packed rhyme. We spoke with Latrell James last June when the Cheerios spot came out, and we started by asking him how he became the voice for Cheerios.
Having friends. That's the best way to put it, yeah. I have friends, and it's just really just a big thank you to Brian from Gratitude Sounds, which is a company in Boston that focuses on licensing music for commercials and television. So, thank you, Brian.
That's how the connection was made?
Absolutely.
Do you think hope is going to open a lot more doors for you?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you can have somebody's voice and people, you know, people like a song that a particular person's attached to and they can hear that all over the world, people are curious of who that person is and what else they have to offer. So, like, it's definitely helped me. And I mean, I like social media wise, you can see that. Mm-hmm. Play wise on my SoundCloud, you can see that. It's pretty cool.
Has anyone said, I just got to ask this,
Has anyone said,
you're selling out?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I would never see it as selling out because I mean, like today, like a stream is worth less than a penny. And artists need other revenue streams to make money. Like, no artist is out here making all their money directly from their music anymore. They're selling merchandise, they're doing tours, and they're partnering up with corporations, a la Chance the Rapper, a la Pusha T. These guys have done commercials with Kit Kat. I just seen Chance on a Twitter commercial,
yeah,
which is pretty crazy. So, like, and Pusha T was on
McDonald's, right.
Those are big things. And even back then, In the 90s, I can recall Biggie Smalls on a St. Ives commercial, and I can recall who else had a St. Ives commercial, like a beer company. Like, these are things that you see. I mean, artists need other ways to make their money, so.
Absolutely a fair point. You know, since you mentioned Chance the Rapper and Pusha T, what do you think it is about hip-hop that makes it such a great voice or, part of ad campaigns for huge companies? Why do you think they're doing that?
Hip-hop has its thumb on the pulse of the youth.
Yeah.
And that's just what it is. It's a youth driven market. And not only is it just youth driven, it's connected all of the ages from back with KRS-One to even now. So like those people still listen to this music. It's a growing pond of people who love hip hop. And like that's one of the coolest things out here. It's ever changing. There's a new star every 2 years. Like who wouldn't want to be a part of hip hop?
So we talked about Cheerios. We got that out of the way. Let's talk about your other music.
Absolutely.
And I'd love to have you play some for us. How about Beautiful Day?
Sure. Yeah. Look. Woke up my inner demon, an angel with plans of scheming. Trouble season while your pastor is beaming, gleaming. Pistol squeezing and relieve you of expensive sneakers. The stamp receiving, everybody got that diabetes. Sugar levels in movie theater shootings, They raised the marathon in the city of Lord, Massachusetts, the streets are flooded with students. Some of them lack class, ironic, most of them stupid. And the ones who ain't pursue it, ride around in that Buick, And the mentality, they own everything you get. So your jewelry's useless, security's useless. People die every day, how we gonna be immune to it, huh? Possessed brothers with weapons in their possession. Get exercise in facilities of correction. Serves aid and come out with all this aggression. Then repeats the same thing, cause nobody hires a felon, Then lines of what isn't important. Skip lines of employment and jumping lines for Jordans. These lines distorted, some lines were snorted. Lines that shouldn't be crossed, enemies back and forth, it means nothing if it doesn't make you happy. peer pressure lands you in the pack of patty. Had to follow choice, follow suit, or follow your voice. Get your education and forever owe your Auntie Sally. Good morning. Yeah, good morning. Get your education and forever. Look, I said, had to follow choice, follow suit, or follow your voice. Get your education. Look, look.
That was cool. That was Latrell James performing his song, Beautiful Day.
See.
Right here in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that song, it's got some love, some honest love.
Absolutely.
For Massachusetts and for Boston. So many lines that we could talk about, like Massachusetts, the streets are flooded with students. Some of them lack class.
Mm-hmm.
Ironic, most of them stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about Beautiful Day.
It's a song I wrote because it's the total opposite of what the title is. And I think that like we all wake up and say it's a beautiful day outside, but there's a lot of truth amongst people just walking around the city, truth amongst myself. So like I just want to reflect about the honest side of things. Particularly that line is just a reflection of, you know, like I felt like when I went to college and had no clue of what I wanted to do. I only went because my peers were going. And I felt like, you know, that's a stupid decision. You should go when you know what you want to do and pursue and not go just to go. So that's where I know a lot of my peers felt the same way, too. So that's where that line comes from. Massachusetts, the streets are flooded with students. We got kids traveling from all over the world to come pursue school at prestigious colleges, MIT, Harvard, and a lot of them don't know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they don't know what they want to be 4 years from now. So, like, that's where that line comes from.
Well, and then you also talk about people not being able to get jobs because they'd been formerly incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
So,
possessed brothers with weapons in their possession, get exercising facilities of correction, serves aid and come out with all the aggression and repeats the same thing because nobody hires a felon. Yeah. It's the truth.
Yeah,
that's literally the cycle, and it happens a lot in urban communities in Boston. So, like, I'm just going to tell you the ugly truth, and you have to accept it over such a pretty beat.
So tell me more about how you grew up in Dorchester?
See.
Yeah. So tell me, how did that influence what's in your music now?
It's amazing because Dorchester is so diverse. I mean, like going down towards Bowdoin Street, Cape Verdean community is huge. And then you go down to Geneva Ave and around Dorchester Ave. The Vietnamese community is huge. And then you can also take Dorchester Ave straight into Mass Ave, which leads to some of the biggest universities in the world. Like, you get to see some of the toughest streets at the same time, and you can literally take a bus and get to one of the most prestigious colleges in the world. So, like, when you get that dichotomy, it affects you.
Mm-hmm.
It affects you a lot. And that's what my music is.
So tell me more about how it affected you.
Me in particular? I mean, like, it was strange because I have 5 other siblings besides myself. So, like, I didn't grow up getting everything I wanted, but I also got to see, like, you know, you don't need everything you want to be happy. I was in an apartment, and then right next to me, like, Dorchester's weird. You can be in an apartment, and your best friend could be in, like, one of the best houses in the world. Like, and it's like, wow, your house is beautiful. Like, there's just that much difference in class. Those things literally shape me because I know the difference between, like, that didn't change. It doesn't matter if you're in that situation, if you're going to private schools or not. Like, a human is a human. That's why I look at everything now. It's like, all right, that's a human being. They can be going to the most prestigious school in the world. They can have all of this. But, like, you're a human because you live next door to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, how did you get into music?
My mom, honestly. My mother and father listened to a lot of, like, oldies around the house, a lot of Parliament, a lot of Bootsy Collins, Kraftwerk. My mom is, like, super diverse when it comes to music, so she didn't just let us listen to one thing. Eventually, I just wanted to pick up and learn how to do it. I started rapping, like, at 12, and my mom couldn't afford to purchase beats for me, so I begged her to buy me a program, FL Studio, and me and my brother learned how to produce. We would just come home from school, do our homework, and just produce every day. And eventually, we got okay at it, I guess.
Or maybe more than okay,
yeah.
Right? All right, well, can we have you do another song for us?
Sure.
How about Candles?
Cool.
Oh,
oh yeah, I'm grateful for another. Thank my sister, mother, father, and my brothers, oh yeah, oh yeah. Say happy birthday, say happy birthday. I remember when things were oh so simple. Saturday cartoons, Sega, Super Nintendo. Learning my ABCs, a brother still say elemental. How it go from that to me getting my first pimple. I really hated school, look at all the hell I went through. Sally Mae on my back, you think they care, brother, rent due? Torn between filling my pockets and trying to fill venues. I could kill a person, but James, they'll go a rental. Momento, I'm about the game momentum. About to buy my family homes, I ain't never considered written. Live enormous or die dormant, Jay Dinks for the way of living. Ain't met a person that ain't wanna be Jordan over Pippen. Is you kidding? I thought I'd never grow up. I got a room full of folks hoping I never blow up. Praying that they take off the same time they slow up. Man, don't get your hopes up. Egg me on, get yoked up. I tell my exes, so what? I tell them, brother, so what? And since everybody's a boss, who the hell gon' own up to living filet mignon lifestyle when they pockets cold cut? No such thing as penny pinching and pimping people. Hold up, that's word to Martin Lawrence. Until I'm riding in foreigns, my reign has begun. Beware, people was pouring. When you doing something right, look at everybody eye you, trying to blow my candles out before I do. Hold up, they told me do better, but never better than them. I let these fools catch up. Never again, I kept it moving, people. When they were settling in, I felt the room's pressure. I survived, no wonder why they wanna blow my candles out, ay. One by one, ay. They wanna blow my candles out, ay. One by one. Can a brother celebrate cause he made it to 23? Can a brother have his cake without you hollering for a piece? By any means, but I'm still hollering for some peace. But if a sucker disrespect, I'll be hollering, get the peace. Give him a piece of mind before he's left resting in peace. Cause I wouldn't mind the peace, and funerals aren't cheap. You seen the price of a headstone lately? They bury Mike in a Promethean wooden cross is what Jesus gets. Dying's the easiest, but living and believing it is meaningless. It's hard to believe the reaper is a step around the corner, a block from where you stay. And he's always in the hood, that sickle ready to play. Seen the grim grin on the brother who robbed me for my J's. I took them sneakers off and got to live another day. Cause no material possession worth my well-being. I got a few folks mad to hear that trail breathing. I'm doing better than ever, better than I could imagine. No, I'm lying, doing better than teachers who told me rapping was the last thing that I should be considering success in. Ironic, with teachers the average paying profession. Them are wrong for wanting gourmet meals, not out the drive-thru. This world a killer, brother. Ask Janet how they did Michael. When you doing something right, look at everybody eye you, trying to blow my candles out before I do. Hold up, they tell me do better, but never better than them. I let these fools catch up. Never again, I kept it moving, people. When they were settling in, I felt the room's pressure. I survived, no wonder why they wanna blow my candles out, ay. One by one, ay. They wanna blow my candles out, ay. One by one.
That was so good.
Thank you.
Latrell James performing Candles.
Thank you.
Live for us right here.
Thank you very much.
Is that song, is that your story?
Yeah, that's really my whole story right there.
Because, I mean, every line is so packed.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that the lines come together around a section, for example, where the word peace is used in like four different contexts, one right after the other? Can you, like, how do you make that happen?
So, like, it's weird for me. Like, when I think of words, I just don't think of words as like, hey, it's a word like peace.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think about it like, how do people use these words in their regular day context? What's the power behind the word peace?
Right.
Not just peace itself. Like, you know, you can be a piece to a puzzle. You can bring peace to something. So, like, I try to think about it in different ways. Every time I hear a word, I'm always thinking about other ways. And I always look into synonyms, too. I love synonyms because words mean a bunch of different things. And I just think it's interesting that you can say red and then you can say red. I read something and then have a color red. It's just, it boggles me.
Because what I loved about that section, though, is that, you know, through the artistry of how you put the words together, you connect, like, these extremes of your life experience, right? Like a piece of cake, like celebrating through the visual, the idea of that piece of cake, celebrating your life through, you know, peace as in, you know, a weapon and the dangers that folks face, you know, on the streets, through peace as in like the idea of peace. And then, as you mentioned, piece of from a puzzle. I mean, it just so elegantly wove all of those things together.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
So I should say that you're performing these songs for us in the studio with a backing track.
Mm-hmm.
But when you perform live, you have a band with you. Usually.
Absolutely. Hip hop is music, and it translates the same way as any other genre to a live band. But the reason why I do it is because a live band can bring out emotions in a record that a two-track cannot do. And there's things that we can do live that I would never be able to do. Like, you know, instrumental is restricted to a time frame. And like when I have a live band, if I want to bring that line, those lines back, or that verse back again, I could bring it back and we can change the way it feels and we can change the energy, take the drums out, just play it with bass and a guitar. So like those are things that I'm really into because I know like words impact people. And the instrumental is great for when you, it's for you to have it while you're mobile. That's what a song is for. It's for you to have it while you're mobile. But a live show is for you to hear and experience there.
Now, I've heard that you've said it in the past that you want to be the greatest rapper. I still think that's entirely possible. But that now maybe you just want to be a great influence. Also possible. So, but what kind of influence is it that you want to have?
That's great research there. Sheesh, I don't remember when I even said that, but I did say that at one point. That's very true. At one time, you know, it was always, hey, I just want to, like, Jay-Z is my favorite rapper. It's like, I just want to be better than Jay-Z. But then when you look back at it, I'm like, do I want to be like Jay-Z or do I want to influence people the way Jay-Z did? And even more so for me, I'm like super involved in my community. So like I want to always give back. And maybe I'm not the greatest rapper, but maybe I inspire the greatest rapper, or maybe I end up producing and helping that the next greatest producer become great. Because like we're given tools and I feel like we should share our tools, our knowledge with people. So like that's when I say influence. I don't want to be the biggest rapper anymore because being the biggest rapper comes with a lot of craziness.
Well put. I have to say though, just hearing you and watching you perform here, your music has the power to put people right in the middle of your experience.
That's what I try.
And that's what I felt hearing
you.
Just now, regardless of the walk of life that a person comes to, I guarantee you everyone hearing this, they're like seeing the world that you're painting with the songs. And if they don't, they should send me an email and tell me why, because that's crazy if they don't. Well, I'm going to be greedy and have us listen to one more of your songs. This one is off your album 12, and it's called Distance. But Latrell, first of all, tell us, what's it about?
My gosh, separating yourself from people that's holding you back. That's really the whole, and that's whether it's family, friends, business associates. It was just more so inspired by watching my little brother grow, and like he's a musician as well, and like he's been doing really amazing things. But it was like a point where he was trying to like, hey, am I going to pursue school or pursue music? And like this was basically my open letter to him, like, hey, you have a choice.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Sure.
This is Distance.
Am I wrong to tell my little brother follow his dreams? How we gonna fail when his friends...
Dorchester hip-hop artist Latrell James. His latest album is called 12. We spoke with him in June. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Differences, they cross the stages. I'm performing on them. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this Friday after Thanksgiving, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews with musicians and composers. We heard how a Dorchester hip-hop artist became the voice of Cheerios, and now we bring you our interview with the legendary Howard Shore. Shore is, of course, a prolific, multiple Oscar-winning film composer. He's written scores for more than 80 movies, everything from David Cronenberg's Crash and Naked Lunch to Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, The Departed, to Tom McCarthy's Spotlight. But there's one score to rule them all.
My precious.
Okay, so it's three scores, really. Howard Shore wrote the music for Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings cycle. He also wrote the score for Jackson's The Hobbit trilogy. Last April, Shore returned to Boston and Berklee College of Music, his alma mater, for a special performance of the Lord of the Rings Symphony, an adaptation of his Oscar-winning film scores.
It was a lengthy process. I think it took about a year to unarchive the score that was written for the film. It's about 12 hours. The symphony is a two-hour piece. It follows the narrative of the story, of Tolkien's story, in a lot of details. So as you, it takes you from the very beginning of the Shire right through to the destruction of the Ring. It's a piece that's I orchestrated for a 96-piece symphony orchestra, a mixed choir, an adult choir, about 60 to 80 singers, a 50-piece boys choir, although I think in Boston we're going to have a girl and boy children choir, plus there's soloists as well.
Imagine that all the Lord of the Rings fans out there listening are scrambling to get tickets. But I also imagine that they want to hear a little bit of the story of how you became part of this epic film project. Did Peter Jackson come to you and say, Howard Shore, you're the one I want to write the music for this huge project I've got going?
He called me one day in the year 2000. And I just picked up the phone, and it was, he said, he introduced himself. He was with Fran Walsh. We talked for about 20 minutes about the film that he was making in New Zealand. I really wasn't aware of a film even being made of this book that I loved. I had read it in the 60s. And he invited me to New Zealand to see the process that they were going through in making the film. So it was an intriguing phone call. I did go down to New Zealand, and I met Alan Lee and John Howe, the great Tolkien illustrators, and saw a lot of the artwork, saw about maybe 16 minutes of film. It was amazing looking, and you wanted to be a part of this, and not that I really knew exactly what I was really taking on, but I didn't want to not be part of it. I never really tired of it, I must say. By the end of those years, they had to kind of drag me away from it because I just kept finding more and more detail in the book. I love Tolkien's writing. I connected to him very much, I think, in terms of nature. Lord of the Rings is essentially a story about the saving of nature, everything right. Green and good. And I think that really struck a chord with me. And I think that was really the connection that allowed me to create a piece that is a mere image of his world, but in music.
You said you had read Tolkien back in the 60s. When you first read The Lord of the Rings, as you were, reading it, were you hearing music in your head also or not?
Well, I write music every day, and I'm an avid reader, and I love fantasy and science fiction, and I love great novels. And I actually read a lot when I'm composing. I find that's it's a good balance. I love the structure of looking at a good paragraph or a good structured sentence. And I think that really helps me compositionally when I'm writing.
Interesting, because I was just wondering if whether or not you could pick up a novel these days and read through it without thinking, oh, how would I write the theme for this character?
I don't actually make that leap. I just
okay.
Yeah, and I don't really with films either. You know, when I first watch a film the first time, I want to just experience it like an audience member. I want to feel, you know, what we should be feeling when we watch the film. I want to relate to it as an audience member would participate in the enjoyment of the film. And I do that with the same with books and literature.
But you were saying a little bit earlier that when you were actually scoring the music for The Lord of the Rings, that you did go back to the books and you were reading them at the same time as part of your process for writing, right?
Yes, very much so. I had the book open on my desk all the time that I was writing, and every scene that I was working on, I would reread Tolkien's, you know, original work.
There's so many scenes we could discuss, but is there one in particular that stands out to you as going back and forth between the score and the scene in the book, and it really came together for you?
Well, the first piece that I wrote is in Fellowship of the Ring, and it's the piece of Mines of Moria, and the Bridge of Khazad-dûm is an exciting sequence. And it was the first thing that I had worked on that had such a huge scope to it. And I always, had a strong connection to creating that, making sure that that was a great piece. It's a 26-minute piece in A Fellowship of the Ring.
Amazing. The music is so exquisitely written, and of course it works so beautifully with the film that it never even occurred to me that it's 26 minutes long, because you're utterly transported for the whole time. The music is as iconic a part of the films as the visual richness of the movies themselves. And I'm thinking particularly, for example, The Ring. The Ring itself, obviously, it's a ring. It doesn't have any dialogue, but it does speak through the music that you wrote for it.
Yes.
And the Ring theme is just so beautiful, but it sort of transforms and it works in different ways. Can you tell me about that, about making The Ring speak?
The Ring actually has three thematic pieces that are related to it. The history of the ring, the power of the ring, and just the evil of the ring.
But, you know, the brilliance of the Ring's leitmotif is that it's at once instantly recognizable, right? Da, 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 da. But then it's also very malleable. How did you do that?
You know, compositionally, I'm writing really the basics of music and harmony and counterpoint before I go to orchestration. So I create everything on the page. I write with pencil. And, you know, my sketches are detailed in a way that I would just, working with the basics of composition, I would develop the pages over time, and I would keep a notebook. But sometimes when I was writing, I'd be in Two Towers, and I'd want to remember a theme, and sometimes I didn't always go back, and I would just use it from my memory, and that kind of developed some of the ideas. You know, I would use a certain meter in the early part of Fellowship of the Ring, and I would do it in three, four in Two Towers. So these things were being developed. I was writing actually for quite a long time, but I was writing so much music that it was just a constant flow. Years ago, I brought Tolkien's The Archive from Marquette University to New York. We did a concert at Radio City Music Hall, and I, in studying his process, you could see that he was also going step by step. It was like a lantern held up in the dark, and we were moving through different parts of the calendar, moon phases, different parts of the seasons affected the story. He was also following, you know, his ideas through this long process of the journey of the story.
Let's just move back in time a little bit, because you are coming back to the Berklee College of Music here for this performance of the Symphony of the Lord of the Rings, and you're an alum as well of Berklee. So when you were a young man, a young student there, what brought you to Berklee College of Music?
I loved improvisation. I loved jazz, and I base a lot of my ideas, I think, from those early days of learning how to write on the intuition that you have as a composer and always on the improvisational part of your thinking. And what I'm doing with even something like Tolkien is I'm free associating his world into my ideas through improvisation. It's the very beginning. And I like that dream state. There's actually a lot of napping, you know, in composition, because I'm trying to enter a kind of subtext into the subconscious to develop those ideas. And I learned that actually from Berklee. Jazz was what brought me there. And it kind of opened up the whole world of music to me. It showed me where the scores were. It showed me the music library. We would study a Bach chorale in the morning, and then we'd learn about Duke Ellington or Charles Mingus. So it gave you a really broad scope of what was possible in music. And frankly, I'm 70 now, but I've been using the ideas I learned from Berklee from the 60s for years and years.
Mr. Shore, you've scored more than 80 films so far in your career. It's an astonishing number. Do you ever kind of look back or look at the list and think, wow?
John Howe is a great illustrator, Tolkien illustrator, and when I would visit him, he would have enormous amounts of pages and illustrations, and I'd say, John, you're producing so much work. He says, just keep the pencil moving. And I took that to heart. And I mean, with music, it's similar. I mean, the pencil moves every day. So every morning I'm writing music, and, you know, it's just pages and pages, and they accumulate over the years. I've been doing it a long time. So I don't feel like I've really written that much music compared to the great composers of the world. But I guess I'm doing my small share in my world. The pencil moves.
Small. I think a lot of people might say no, more than a small share in your world. I know this final question I want to ask. I know it'll be just like asking a parent to choose their favorite child, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you have one or two favorites from all these films that you've worked
from
on?
From these productions?
Yeah.
I would have to say the Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings, because it really was everything at that time that I knew about music. It was a culmination of all of my work in music in terms of orchestration, composition, conducting, producing, recording. It was just everything went into that. So that always is recording that I did that just encapsulated everything I knew about music.
Howard Shore is an Oscar-winning composer. We spoke with him in April. And this is his piece, Into the West, from The Return of the King, the 2003 Oscar winner for Best Original Song. It was written by Howard Shore, Fran Walsh, and Annie Lennox. Stay with us. There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
What can you see?
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this Black Friday, we're spending the hour listening back to conversations with some of our favorite musicians. So whether you're foraging for leftovers or battling traffic to grab one more shopping deal, we've got just the soundtrack to accompany you. Our next artist, Tia Fuller, has been on albums that almost everyone has heard of.
Yes, if I bought it, please don't touch. And keep talking and that's fine. But could you walk and talk at the same time?
This is, of course, Beyoncé's mega hit Irreplaceable from her second album, B-Day. And Tia Fuller is a jazz saxophonist and former member of Beyoncé's all-female touring band. She's also a professor at Berklee College of Music and led the Berklee Beyoncé Ensemble. And when we spoke to her in May, we remembered that Tia also appears in the music video for Irreplaceable with her saxophone, which, by the way, if you haven't heard the version of this song with the full band, it's absolutely worth the listen.
Don't you ever for a second get to thinking, irreplaceable.
Them play the whole thing because it's awesome.
Thank you.
Tia Fuller, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
I love that version with the whole band playing. You guys are so tight in there that I think people would be forgiven for thinking that it's from the original album version because it's so good.
Well, thank you. We actually had no choice but to be tight because we were in 8 to 12 hour rehearsals for a good 6 months out of the year. So yeah, we were living, eating, breathing this music. We had no other option but to be close and be a family.
But I got to get straight to the question that everyone wants to know.
Uh-oh.
What was it like working with Beyoncé?
It was really transformational on so many different levels because I came from a strong jazz background. And once I started playing with her, I saw how the pop industry was very different. And then, of course, working like right in alignment with her and seeing how she speaks to her crew and how she functions as a businesswoman and videos, also in the studio. Just that really, for me, was transformational on a large level because I was able to incorporate a lot of the things that I turn there with being my own band leader.
I mean, she's
all of the details.
She's the whole package.
She is. She
put
really
it mildly.
Is. Yeah.
Now this was back in 2007 to 2009.
Yeah,
right?
This was like 2006 all the way until about 2010.
Oh, 2010.
Yeah.
Okay. How old were you? At that time? But you look so young now.
Thank
that's
you.
What I'm
You're
asking.
Sweet. No, it was 10 years ago. Yeah, it was 10 years ago. Yeah. It was all 10 years ago. So you guys could go on Wikipedia.
We've got some music here of you playing the saxophone, Tia, when you toured with Beyoncé. This is from the Beyoncé Experience World Tour in May 2007. You were all in Antwerp, Belgium.
Won't try to give it up for Tia.
So that's you playing with Beyoncé. I mean, you mentioned something a little earlier that I want to ask you more about. Beyoncé is obviously this sort of musical force of her own, but people don't often think of her in a jazz context, if at all. But what you grew up playing was really different. So tell me more about how that sort of crossover meets in you.
Thank you for that question. I come from a jazz family. My mom is a vocalist. My dad's a bassist. And we have a family band called Fuller Sound. And so my sister plays in the band. My brother-in-law plays drums. And of course, I play saxophone. So coming from that, I've always embraced all types of genres of music, and not only listening, but playing. So once I moved out to New York, I wasn't just playing jazz, but I'd be playing in R&B ensembles and wedding bands and hip-hop bands and Latin orchestras and big bands at church. Even like the jazz aficionados, they're like, you play straight ahead, but I hear a lot of other influences.
In March, right, you actually helped coordinate a show at Berklee that featured the original all-female band, Beyoncé's all-female band, right?
Yes, definitely.
And also the Berklee Beyoncé Ensemble, which we'll talk about in a second.
Okay, yeah.
But I want to play a little clip of that performance from March.
Okay.
So what was it like to reunite?
Oh my goodness. It was like a party from the aunts. I mean, it's always a party, but from that point, it was almost like riding a bike to where we did the show and it was boom. We all hit it, and energy-wise, it was there. Notes we might have been kind of fumbling, but as far, we had done that show so many times and played this music, it's ingrained in our spirit for the rest of our life and even afterlife.
Did you have to dance when you were part of the ensemble?
Definitely.
With your saxophone?
Yeah, in heels, in like four in stilettos.
You had to dance with your saxophone in stilettos.
Choreography. And so this is one thing that we really stressed in the Beyoncé ensemble at Berklee, is that it's not just about the music, but you all have to internalize the music enough in order to reenact it and take ownership over it so that you can do these moves too while you're playing and walking and dancing at times and it looking like you know what you're doing.
Looking fierce.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like Sasha Fierce.
So tell me, this Berklee Beyoncé ensemble, how did it come about?
So when I first started teaching at Berklee about 4 years ago, I remember I spoke to one of my administrators and I had said, I would love to have the girls from Beyoncé's band come and do a show. And this was something that I had kind of planted a seed. I wasn't sure if it was going to happen or not. So then this time last year, the external affairs department, they had come to me and he was like, Tia, we have a big show planned for next year and we want you to direct it. And so who are some artists you'd like to bring? And I was like, well, we can do Lettucey or Dwelle, because I started a Dwelle ensemble. And I was like, well, maybe Jack DeJohnette, or we could go jazz. And I was like, well, we could also do like a Beyoncé 10-year anniversary
concert.
And
they were like, that.
Exactly. I was like, oh, man. Yeah, he was like, I really like the sound of the Beyoncé. And all I could see was just the work and the logistics. But it was I'm just so thankful to be given that opportunity, because it was not only an educational experience for the students, but it's been a reconnecting point for with the OGs, with the band members. And so now we're getting requests to do gigs just as a band.
Fantastic.
And this is something that we had always talked about, but I think we just needed some time to kind of all of us settle into our individual careers, so that now on the other side of it, we're able to really just hone into all of our strengths, which is amazing.
So speaking of your individual strengths, I mean, we're spending a lot of time talking about Queen Bey, but I want to play some of your music, because you're a very accomplished saxophone player. So let's listen to a little bit. This is a piece from your 2012 album, Angelic Warrior. This is Lil Less. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
What do you love about the saxophone?
You know, I remember the first day I blew into the saxophone. I think I was about 8 or 9. I remember I was in the third floor of my parents' house in the loft, and I played like a low B flat, which is the lowest note that you can finger on the saxophone. It was like, boom! And then it just resonated through my whole being. And from that point, I knew this is what I'm supposed to do.
Well, I mean, you're not the first saxophone player to talk about the instrument in mystical ways, right? Like, I'm thinking Coltrane.
Yes. And he is one of my biggest influences, for sure. When I was at Spelman, one of my first transcriptions that I learned, one of the solos that I learned was Coltrane's Giant Steps.
Well, if we could, let's actually listen to some of that. This is John Coltrane playing Giant Steps in 1959. John Coltrane playing Giant Steps back in 1959. And Tia, honestly, it feels a little bit magical hearing Coltrane play.
Yeah, it's a... I think any instrument has that capability. It's just a matter of if you're in tune with it or not. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely my voice. I knew it.
Well, let's listen to more of your voice again through the saxophone. This is from your 2012 album, Angelic Warrior, Ralphie's Groove. So, Tia, let me ask you, you have played with Beyoncé. You teach at Berklee. You've got your own ensembles. You've got some great albums. What's left?
One of my next goals, I'd like to eventually start a school, but I'd also like to receive a Grammy. These are just like some internal goals.
Yeah, you know what? If you're going to aim high.
Yeah.
And I don't see why you couldn't do it, to be perfectly honest.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I actually have a new release coming out at the beginning of next year, and it's featuring Jack DeJohnette, Dave Holland, Bill Stewart, and James Genus, and Terry Lynn Carrington is producing it. So we're really sinking our teeth into that, and we'll see. But, you know, I think more importantly, I'm seeing how important it is to just continue to evolve on a daily basis. I was practicing the other night, and I'm like, man, it's time for me to get to the next level on my instrument. And I think that's a testament for all of us, that we continue to evolve and to cultivate those gifts and our purpose on this earth. And I honestly can say that I'm living a dream, because every single thing that I've done has been even more in abundance than I had asked for. And not to have it self-serving, but to see that through me elevating or pushing myself, I'm able to infuse others.
Tia Fuller is a jazz saxophonist and former member of Beyoncé's all-female touring band. She's also a professor at Berklee College of Music. We spoke with her in May. And that's it for today. Have a great weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.